15 to 20, we read about the two headships of Christ. First of all, Christ as the head of creation. In verse 15 onwards, Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for in him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. Notice all these important prepositions. The universe was made in Christ, it was made through Christ, it was made for Christ, and it was made by Christ. And so he is the head of creation. But perhaps last Sunday evening I ought to have been more careful with my language and speak about the old creation and the new creation. Because the old creation, you see, has been invaded. There's another creation on the go, and that's the new creation. And the new creation began when Christ's body rose from the dead, because the risen, the resurrected, glorified Christ is God's seed of a new universe. That's why we sometimes sing in our hymn, "The church's one foundation is Jesus Christ, her Lord." She is his new creation by water and the word. And so there are two creations on the go. There's the old one, fallen, destined eventually to be burned on the day of judgment. And inside that, there is God's new creation. And the church of Jesus Christ is a kind of pledge from God of the new creation that will come when Jesus Christ comes again. C.S. Lewis puts it beautifully in his book on the miracles, and he says, "You know how in springtime you see snowdrops and crocuses, and the bulbs have been hidden there under the winter snows, and the world is frozen in winter. But as soon as you see the snowdrops and the crocuses, you know that the year has turned, and these little flowers are pledges from God that the spring is on the way, and someday the summer will come." Now Christians, excuse me, are God's snowdrops. They are God's crocuses. They are the harbingers. If you were listening to the children's address this morning, they were the harbingers. They are the avant-couriers, the forerunners of that great and tremendous day when the old creation will be destroyed and out of its ashes a new creation will be made, a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwell righteousness. And so you see, every time God makes a person a Christian, he makes a kind of promise. It's a kind of promise and a pledge of the new creation. And so Christ is the head of the old world because he made it. He's the head of all creation. But tonight we'll think how Christ is the head of the new creation, which is the church. And we read of that in verse 18 onwards. He is the head of the body, the church, this pledge of the new world, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from amongst the dead, first man to rise from the dead, so that in everything he might be preeminent. And maybe I could simplify things this evening, and it's always good to simplify things in a sermon, by giving the structure of what I want to do. It's very simple. 2, 3, and 4. Two kinds of power. Three kinds of relationship. And four kinds of subjection, and at the heart of all that you find Christ, the head of the church. Because you see, this is not a bit of teaching that stands on its own. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. Jesus Christ the head, and Christians the limbs and the feet and the legs and the toes. This is not a bit of teaching that stands alone, because it's related to a whole world of Christian truth. It stands at the heart of a web of Christian teaching. And so I'll say that again. Two kinds of power, three kinds of relationship, and four kinds of subjection. And if you understand this, then you understand the idea of Christ being the head of the church. First of all, two kinds of power. And you know that in the Greek there are two different words for power, and they have different meanings, although they are translated power and sometimes authority. The first word is dunamis, from which we get the English dynamo or dynamic. The second word is not so familiar. It's the Greek word exousia. And the difference between dunamis, power, and exousia, power, is this: that dunamis power is power in itself. It's not power that comes from anywhere. Here's a poor illustration. If you were to go round up there, which heaven forfend, with a pair of scissors and cut all the wires from these bulbs, then we would be in darkness, because these bulbs do not have light in themselves. They must derive the power for this light from somewhere else. And you could follow the wires, presumably, and if you went far enough, you would come to a hydroelectric power station. Now, if you imagine the power station as being dunamis power, dynamite power, dynamic power, power in itself, and all of this as exousia power, then you've got the difference between dunamis and exousia. Exousia power is power that's handed down. It's authority and might and rule. And it's handed down. And it all comes from dunamis power. Power in itself. Power that you cannot challenge. Omnipotent power. Omnipotent power. Might and majesty and power that is not derived from anything else. And of course, the power that God has is that kind of power, and all other kinds of power are exousia. They are handed down from God. Now you see this very wonderfully in Luke's Gospel in chapter 20, where the word exousia, handed down power, is used throughout this chapter. Luke's Gospel, chapter 20. Although actually, Luke seems to be very interested in this word exousia, because it's used on quite a number of occasions, most memorably by the centurion who said to Jesus, "I also am a man set under authority. I'm like you. I'm under orders from above." That was faith, you see, for a Roman pagan to look into the eyes of Christ and recognize that Jesus Christ was under another power. That was real faith. It's a great story. "I also am a man set under authority like you." Now the word he uses is exousia, power handed down. You'll find it in Luke then, chapter 20, the business of where Christ got his authority from. One day as he was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests And the scribes with the elders came up and said to him, "Tell us, by what authority you do these things? Where do you get this power from? Where are your credentials? Or who is it that gave you this authority?" Now you see, they consistently use the word exousia, power that's handed down to men. He answered them, not without humor, "I also will ask you a question. Now tell me, was the baptism of John the Baptist from heaven or from men?" And they saw that they were trapped, you see. And they discussed it with one another, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say, 'Why then did you not believe John the Baptist? Why didn't you listen to his preaching if it came from heaven?' But if we say, 'Oh, it was from men,' then all the people will stone us, for they are convinced that John the Baptist was a prophet." And so they were trapped. They couldn't say yes or no. They couldn't say John came from heaven, and they couldn't say John came from earth. And so they answered that they did not know whence it was. And Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. I'm not going to tell you where my power comes from. But we know where his power came from. His power came from the dunamis power, the dynamic power." And so there are two kinds of power at work in the world today. My Christian friend, I want to spell out loud and clear that the whole fabric of law and order and government and stability in the world hang upon the exercise of that quality of exousia, authority that has been handed down from God. And I've written down a list here of all the people to whom God has given this kind of power. Policemen have it. They are there to exercise law under God. Teachers and headmasters have it. Parents have it. Kings have it. And prime ministers and members of parliament, Christians have it. Ministers of the gospel have it. And elders of the church have it. Absolute power in heaven has entrusted authority to these figures, whom I sometimes call authority figures, because these are the people whom we acknowledge to be authoritative people, and they are the representatives of God's power. They are the ambassadors of God's power. Christian parent, did you know that you are an ambassador of absolute power? And that your children are watching you? And that they're judging God by what they see of you? Christian teachers, are you aware that children in your classroom are watching you? And they are judging God's power and God's person. By what they see of you, Christian elders, are you aware that God has entrusted power to you? That you are an authoritative person? That men and women and boys and girls are looking up to you for a lead? For leadership? Christian ministers, I don't exclude myself, headmasters, bearers of God's power, the ambassadors of absolute power. And this is why all authoritative persons must live very scrupulous lives. I wouldn't like to think that any man or woman was lost forever because of my careless life. I wouldn't like to think that a boy or a girl in our Sunday school or anywhere else in Inverness grew up to be a pagan or an unbeliever or an agnostic or an atheist because of what he or she saw in me. People who have exousia, the power of God, delegated power, handed down power upon them, must live the most guarded and careful of lives. Secondly, three orders of headship, three kinds of relationship. And will you turn for this to 1 Corinthians chapter 11? And again, if you understand this, you understand what the scriptures have to say about obedience to authority. And it can be said in three sentences. Can you drink this in? It's so simple. It's so tremendous that it's simple. And it's so simple that it's tremendous. A child could take this in. In fact, perhaps children are the best people to take it in. God is the head of Christ. Christ is the head of the church. And the husband is the head of the wife. Three relationships and three kinds of headship. God, the head of Christ, marvelous, absolutely one in power, one in substance, one in glory, and yet Jesus Christ forever within the Holy Trinity, bowing to God the Father. He is God himself. He's God the Son, and yet because he is God the Son, he bows down. And so forever, at the very heart of the Trinity, you get equality and subjection. If you don't understand marriage relationships, think of the Trinity. How is it that a husband and wife can be equal, and yet the wife is subject to the husband, and the husband is the head of the wife? Well, if you don't understand it, look into the very heart of the Godhead, and you find God the Father and God the Son exactly equal with each other. And yet you find God the Son bowing to the will of his Father, the servant Christ, the obedient Christ. Here am I. God is the head of Christ. And underneath that, and because of that, Christ is the head of the church. Although so many people have other different ideas. You see, nowadays it's committees that are the head of the church, or it's reason that's the head of the church, or it's tradition that's the head of the church. But because God is the head of Christ, Christ is the head of the church, and because Christ is the head of the church, and he is the bridegroom, and the church is his bride, the husband is the head of the wife. Now, if you understand this, you understand how integral these relationships are when it comes to the question of Christian conduct. Did you read that awful case this week of the woman who got a divorce from her husband, and he was a leading elder in the exclusive Plymouth Brethren because he treated her as if she was just one of his possessions. In fact, he used to tell her that he bought her. She belonged to him, and he could lord it over her because he had bought her, and she had no life of her own. And she bullied that poor woman, an elder in a church. Wicked brute. He hadn't read his Bible, or if he'd read it, he hadn't understood it. Is this how Christ treats the church? Does Jesus Christ bully his church? Does he chivvy along Christians? Does he always have the big stick out? Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. As Christ loved the church. Wives, be subject to your husbands as the church is subject to Christ. So integral, you see. And you cannot challenge these categories of subjection and headship without really upsetting society. The unisex movement, you know, the hair and the flare trousers, so that if a boy with flare trousers is standing up straight, he looks as if he were wearing an evening dress. You know, it comes out like that. And in shadow, in silhouette, you would hardly tell if he's wearing an evening dress. And the boys wear shoes, you know, the platform, the clompity clomp shoes, I call them, these big high shoes. And they're just girls' shoes. You see, the girls wear them as well. There's no difference. Because the difference between the sexes, you see, has been bulldozed. It's been annihilated. Look at Shirley Bassey, if you don't mind me saying that. Look at Shirley Bassey. And in one of her shows, she was wearing this gorgeous evening dress. She goes in for marvelous clothes and diamonds. They say her diamond collection is really worth something, even if she can't sing for toffee. And she stood there with this lovely outfit on, and then she moved, and it was trousers. Culottes, I think they call them, culotte. You see? Now, we may think these things are funny, but why is it that the difference between boy and girl, male and female, man and woman, it's the difference between husband and wife now is being ironed out, you see? It's because in our generation, this whole fabric of the orders of headship and subjection has really been challenged. And you cannot challenge that order, you see, without upsetting the moral balance and the authority structures in society itself. Now, that Paul is very clear on this in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2. He says, I commend you because you remember me in everything, and maintain the traditions even as I have delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that this is beautifully done, and it's so simple, that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. The deepest things are always the simplest. That's so simple. Let's just read it again, that third verse. The whole moral fabric of society. The head of every man is Christ. The head of a woman is her husband. And the head of Christ is God. Integral. They hang together. And lastly, four subjections. Ephesians chapter 5. And he starts with his kind of text at verse 21. You see, he's going to speak about subjection. He says, "Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. If you love Jesus Christ, if you honor Jesus Christ, then you will take notice of this." And at four points he speaks about subjection. Some people may not care for this, but it's in the Bible whether people care for it or not. For example, in chapter 6 and verse 1, there is the first subjection. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." And it's interesting that that's the only command given to children in the whole of the New Testament. Of course, parents have to love their children. Parents haven't to bully their children, and they haven't to use their children. So many parents use their children and manipulate their children, getting them to take sides in family quarrels when husband and wife are having an argument, and asking the children to take sides is a horrid thing. It's cruel. And what's even worse, parents manipulating their children, trying to get rid of their frustrations through their children. You see it in parents who didn't have a very happy childhood and didn't have a good education, forcing their children on in school. And they're really trying, you see, to get rid of their own inhibitions and frustrations through their children. Terribly wrong. Parents should love their children. Be kind to their children. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord." That's another important qualification. "For this is right. Honor your father and mother." This is the first commandment with a promise in it. So many of God's commandments have no promises, but this is a promise one. "That it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth." And here is an important verse. "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Don't force them to grow up to be rebels, but bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord." So that's children, be subject. Verse 5, difficult if you don't know who the boss is. "Servants, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters." Nowadays, businesses are so big, you know, that you wonder whom you're supposed to obey. You know, there's a joke going around the offices in London, and somebody says to the girl at the switchboard, "If the boss rings, try and find out his name," because they were all busy working away in the office and they had no idea who the head of the firm was. So I suppose this is easier to put into practice in a small firm, as would have been the case in the Roman Empire. But we have to do our best to put it into practice here. "Servants, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters with fear and trembling," because you're not doing it for them, "with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart, as to Christ." You have to work for the firm as if you were working for Jesus Christ himself. Not very easy. "Not in the way of eye service as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ." Teachers, you must teach the children as if you were doing it for Jesus Christ himself. "Doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to men. And so on. And a word for the masters in verse 9. They haven't to bully their servants. But it's from verse 22 that I'm interested. Chapter 5 and verse 22. Here are two subjections here. Children to parents, servants to masters, and tied up very, very closely together. Wife and husband, and of course the thing that's at the heart of it all, the church to Christ. The deepest truth is always simple. Christian men, if you're not sure how to treat your wife under certain circumstances, say to yourself, now, how does Jesus treat the church? Or Christian wives, if you're not sure how you should treat your husband, say to yourself, does the Christian church behave like this towards Jesus Christ? Because it's a parallel subjection. Husbands and wives, Christ and the church. The deepest truth is always simplest. 22, wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. Watch these qualifications. They're bridles. B-R-I-D-L-E-S. For the husband is the head of the wife. Some of you didn't see it. For the husband is the head of the wife, just as Christ is the head of the church. How important. Just as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and himself its Savior. And so, verse 24, as the church is subject to Christ, as the church is subject to Christ, that's the bridle, so let their wives be subject in everything to their husbands. And husbands, love your wives sacrificially till it costs, as Christ loved the church, gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. 28, so husbands should love their wives just as they love their own bodies. He who loves his wife really loves himself. It's to his own advantage. For no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it. Here it is again. As Christ nourishes and cherishes the church, because we are members of his body, we are limbs of his body. He's the head, he's the brain, he's up top. We are the limbs. For this reason, a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, Genesis chapter 2, is joined to his wife. Eve comes back to Adam. I often speak about it at the wedding reception. Adam, with his rib missing, is a wounded Adam. He's not quite complete. And Eve, without Adam, is a floating rib. Until she comes back to her husband. And when Eve comes back to Adam, they too shall be one flesh. That's marriage. For this reason a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two of them shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, and I take it to mean, he's not sure what he's speaking about, human marriage or the spiritual marriage, the great romance of history, Christ looking for a bride, or just ordinary romances, chaps looking for wives. I take it to mean Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife just as he loves himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. This is how I put it to young people when they come here to be married. Reading through the marriage service, and we say that marriage is a solemn thing because, and I quote the words of the marriage service, it is a symbol of the mystical union between Christ and the church. What we do here at our wedding is a symbol of the mystical union between Christ and the church. And it's interesting that the marriage service goes on, therefore marriage should not be entered upon lightly or unadvisedly. It's because this is a drama. See, at every wedding, a little drama is rehearsed. Christ waits for his bride. And at the end of the age, the church, the bride of Christ, will be presented to Jesus Christ in heaven. And every time a wedding takes place, here in a church on earth, it's a drama. It's an enactment. It's a representation of the Christian church, white, white robes, pure, being presented to Jesus Christ. Therefore, marriage should not be entered upon lightly or unadvisedly. Four subjections: children to their parents, servants to their masters, wives to their husbands. And at the very heart of it all, the church subject to Christ. What's the challenge of all of this for me? Well, here's the challenge. If the church is his body, he's the brain, he's the head of the church. He's the brain, and we are the limbs, fingers and elbows and legs and arms of Jesus Christ. Now, isn't there something sick in our body? If the brain gives the signal and nothing happens, something wrong with the nerves, something wrong with the muscles, something wrong with the bones. If the brain says, now come on, do this, and nothing happens, it means the body is diseased. Now the challenge of this for me is that if Christ is the head of the body, as soon as the head gives the order, I obey. It's very fast, the doctors tell us. The brain signal, you know, the changes, the current going along the nerves. Very fast. It's so fast, so often we don't need to think about it. Like blinking your eyes. It goes on automatically. Or breathing. You're all breathing just now. But you're not breathing intentionally. You're not saying, now I breathe in, and now I breathe out. Life would be intolerable if you had to do that all the time. Well, see, now I will open my eyelids, and now I will close my eyelids. You see, it's so fast. The brain said, snap your finger. And it is. All sorts of things happening in there. Chemical changes. Current. Energy. Starting from here, Jesus Christ says to the church, do this! The church is here to obey, for Christ is the head of the church. Amen. May God bless his word to our hearts.